clip chaining with a cord, and this is part 3 in a training series on the life and annuity standard. This session is focusing on defining the standard itself. What does it mean to have the standard? How is it delivered to you? What can you use from it? And the overall standards process. How does the standard evolve? How can you influence it? How can you be assured that if you're using this, the standard isn't going to stay where it is and it can expand with you and grow with your changing needs. The standard itself is expressed in this slide I have that looks essentially like a pyramid. At the base of the pyramid itself is what we call our data dictionary. What you'll find is that elements in our data dictionary are global in nature, meaning if I give you a definition of an address or target premium, that definition is going to apply everywhere in the model. Any messages that uses this property called target premium is going to use it similarly and have the same definition. So that's really the foundation, is this individual data dictionary where all of the elements are defined uniquely and globally. Above that, we have, or built upon that base, we have an object model. The object model, or sometimes called the data model, these terms are slightly interchangeable, is also called the OLIFE. It's called OLIFE because, as we'll get into this later, OLIFE is the parent tag in XML. It's the container, if you will, of the object model. This is the business information that is modeled the same regardless of the message. Information about an agent will be modeled the same in the object model regardless of the business message that you're trying to convey. So obviously built on top of that is our next tier, the business message itself. On this layer, also called TX Life, or Transactions for Life, is the tier of the definitions of all of the individual messages. An individual message will combine then the objects that are defined on the object model, which is using elements defined in the data dictionary, to create a message that I can exchange and give to my partner. I can create a new business application form, message, and send it to my trading partner. Finally, within the standard, we have this the definition of workflows or implementation guides. If you remember, we have this intersection of the three P's, the intersection of the product, the process, and the participant or the trading partner. And that's really the world in which an implementation guide lives. It says for underwriting requirement information, case statusing information between carriers and, let's say, service providers, perhaps maybe even including distributors in there. How do we want these messages to work? What do we consider to be important in between those three P's and in this sort of process and in this very specific message? And that's where implementation guides give you some very useful granularity to the messages. That doesn't mean that they're the only way of doing business. Obviously, I can use that business, an application message or an underwriting requirement message with other trading partners or for other processes, but the implementation guide will help with a very specific implementation and can often be the quickest answer to the quickest to your questions on how to implement an individual message. In the next slide, I'm trying to convey the specification documents, what you're actually given or what you can actually download from the standard and what it means when we talk about the standard, or sometimes we call it the specification or the spec. I should interject here that just like I talked about on the last slide where we had an object model or a data model or OLIFE, or we had a business message or a transaction or TX Life, as the standard has evolved, both within Accord and in the horizontal standards such as XML, SOAP, and some of these other intersecting technologies, we've evolved in our terminology. Unfortunately, that means that we also want to make sure we don't lose the semantic of what the message was originally trying to say, and the members that were using it back when we called it properties instead of elements or aggregates instead of objects. It'll make a little more sense as I move on. The same sort of thing happens here. So we have the standard, or the specification in this case. Continuing on, we see the specification is made up of schemas. This is probably the first place that an engineer or a developer goes to look to see what the standard allows them to do. Because that's kind of common in today's philosophy and today's development of XML standards in general or XML messages, which tend to go to the schemas first. Unfortunately, as you'll see, the schema is probably not the best place to start. I guess it's not a bad place to start. I guess the problem is we want to make sure that it's not the only place that we would start. Because as we'll soon learn, I would venture to say at least as much, in fact, I would probably say that more of the rules and the processing guidelines around the standard itself are in the help file, in the narrative section, in the narrative documentation, which we talk about on this next point. And if you look at the schema without looking at the life help file, you'll get lost, or you'll end up creating messages that aren't going to be very processable. Also, the schemas are intentionally not vague, but intentionally open, where we define sections in the model that essentially have no requirements, because we don't know how you're going to use agent information. Should we require an agent number? Well, it might make sense if I was modeling an agent that all agents have to have agent numbers, until you try to go to create a message to request appointment of an agent, or to request an agent number for an agent. In that message, I need to still send you information about the agent, their name, their address, etc., but I don't have an agent number. So if you looked at just at the schemas, it would look like the model has very little guidance and very little standard definition to the way that these messages are modeled, and that's just not true. If you continue on and look at the help file, you'll find much more. You'll find the objects, the properties, and the type codes, and this stuff is listed all in very normative fashion. Definitions of everything from the messages to the elements. It will give you the structure of the XML, and give you also probably one of the most important sections is section 4, which gets into some implementation conventions, where you'll find best practices, general rulings, implementation recommendations, etc., and some of the things that are a little easier to explain in a narrative session, like you would expect in a white paper or a Word document, than you would expect to see in a reference manual. We also include in the specification something called our metadata. Currently in the life and annuity standard, the metadata is itself an XML file. It's an XML file using tags and definitions that's at this point in time proprietary to Accord. Not proprietary in the protected sense and nobody understands it, but proprietary in the sense that when we originally created it, there weren't things such as BPEL, topic maps, RDF, OWL, some of these things that and technologies and standards that exist today. So I would expect, not only expect, I know that we're actually working on creating our standard definitions in those more standardized formats, and I would expect to see those in the very near future. In the meantime, we use this thing called our metadata. In concept, it will be the same. It's just today we use a very standard or a very proprietary format. For an example of that, go to the website, download the standard, and it'll include the metadata. Finally, there are public documents, which are PDFs. We have XML samples of messages, type code definitions that are published in PDF documents and that sort of thing that make the standard very publicly accessible, so that it's possible for members to, or it's possible for trading partners to be able to exchange business in a standardized format using the Accord standard without requiring that their trading partner become a member. So if we break this down a little bit further, then finally there's we mentioned in that tier in my pyramid, I talked about implementation guides. But in the prior slide, you'll notice the implementation guides weren't included as one of the deliverables as part of the spec or the standard itself. The reason for that is technically, and this is going to create some concern and consternation from many individuals, technically the implementation guide isn't part of the standard itself. That might cause a little concern because, quite frankly, the implementation guides are a very powerful resource, and they help individual trading partners in individual processes with a great deal of guidance on what information to include in a message. However, it's important to note that our messages are intentionally fairly macro at a very high level in order to be able to encourage reuse. And that means that in my particular circumstance, if I'm working with a particular trading partner, my use case, my business need may not fit exactly one of the particular implementation guides. The implementation guides, by their very nature, try to be very, very granular and specific to a process. The more specific, in fact, that we can get them, the more help we can give you and assistance we can give you in implementing a particular business message or a particular process. But even in doing that, we realize that's not the only way to do business, and we're not trying to restrict or confine that. So the implementation guides themselves can't really be part of the standard themselves. They can define how to do business today, but they're not constrained by things like compatibility, making sure a message in the past works with a message in the future, and those sorts of things. They can be a little bit free, a little bit more free, giving you a little bit more power, but also meaning they have to give up some of that normative fashion to be part of the traditional specification. Finally, I want to talk about the evolution of the standard itself. The standard evolves. We're in version 2.15, which means we've had 15 releases since the last major one, which was some years ago. And this is done primarily by you, the member. The standard evolves by the submission of a maintenance request from a member or by working groups that we'll talk a little bit later, which is essentially a collection of members who get together and say a particular area of the standard could be defined more clearly, needs additional information, we need a new message, etc. And then all the members or individual member will get together, create a maintenance request, it's called, and submit it to Accord. That's submitted to a email box, lifemr@accord.org. There's forms available on the web. That's our team site. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail of where to get that information. It's all available out there on teams.accord.org. And if you look around there, you'll be able to find it. And any questions can be sent to life@accord.org, and we can put you in touch with forms that you would need to do that. The standards process, again, though I said it's members or working groups, predominantly starts with working groups, predominantly in terms of number of maintenance requests we see each session. A working group is an Accord-facilitated, an Accord-run group of members that have come together in an antitrust protected environment to be able to help us define messages, model data, and ensure that the standard is meeting today's needs. Most of the meetings are conducted virtually. These are done usually biweekly, occasionally weekly, and occasionally only monthly, but in general biweekly is a good goal. We currently do still have face-to-face meetings in the working groups. These happen at most two times a cycle. A cycle is roughly 6 months. But they're not required, and you can still, in fact, be a participant in the working group without requiring travel to one or two working groups every cycle. So don't let any concern about travel preclude you from joining a working group. The working groups also track their progress, their agenda, their outstanding to-dos, their meeting minutes, etc., all on the team site. So even if you can't make a call or you can't make a face-to-face, you can follow the working group. In fact, I would say that by and large, 80%, maybe more, of our active members even are not active in the working groups themselves or active in the sense that they're sending messages and interacting and collaborating. They're active in the sense that they're, well, I guess it'd be passive, but they're active in the sense that they're reading the minutes, they're following the standard, they're asking questions when they need clarification, they're hopefully voting, but they're not necessarily participating in an actual working group in a public sense. Finally, after a maintenance request is submitted, we get towards the end of each cycle and we have a voting process. The voting process is done biannually, and it basically is a weekly cycle of Accord creating reports that include all of the maintenance requests. The reports go out to members. Members will read a maintenance request, have a question. We encourage answering the questions directly, meaning that instead of trying to append the MR with a comment that, or the maintenance request with a comment that says, I don't like this because. We encourage members to go out to the team site, or even when possible, send an email directly to the submitter of the maintenance request or the chair of the working group and ask, what's that maintenance request trying to do, and resolve those conflicts. But at the very least, if there's discomfort or an inability to do that, we have the ability to amend the maintenance request with members' comments, questions, and concerns. The submitter then is able to respond to that in similar fashion, and then the cycle continues with a new report that's generated, et cetera, every week or so until finally, at the end of 6 months, we do a voting. The voting that we do generally starts with something that we call plenary. Plenary is a gathering of members, both virtually and face-to-face, where we discuss any remaining issues that may be outstanding on maintenance requests just before we go to vote. We try to resolve those issues collaboratively, modify the maintenance request if necessary, until we're finally ready to vote. Additionally, and probably even more importantly, as we draw near to the voting cycle, we have a maintenance review group. And the maintenance request review group meets weekly as we near the end, monthly as initially, but as we near the end of voting cycle, they'll meet as frequently as weekly to look at the maintenance requests that are outstanding. They'll vet them fully, and you could really think of that as being a mini plenary, if you will, to vet a maintenance request and get those questions on back to the submitter, so we don't have this big rush at the end of the cycle to be able to do voting. Finally, after everything's voted, we have a 75% approval. A maintenance request is approved. It gets added to the standard. The standard is changed, and we create a new release. The new release comes out as a release candidate initially. This allows members to look at it and say, yes, what I requested was implemented the way I expected. The schema got updated, a help file got changed, a definition got changed, etc. When that vetting process is complete, everybody is comfortable with what's there, then the new release is generated and we have the final standard itself. Because of that, we have a major version, a minor release coming out every 6 months, potentially technical updates, and then that release candidate or draft that I was talking about. We have a not necessarily complex, but we have a fairly complex versioning mechanism. The first digit in the version number itself is broken down into three parts. The first part is the major version. Right now we're on the major version 2 of the Accord Life and Annuity Standard. That major version number is essentially a promise of compatibility. It means that as long as the major version is 2, the basic business semantic of something that was designed early on, say address, is the same and will be represented the same throughout the entire life of the standard, as long as we're on version 2. So something like address will always be address. It's not going to become something more specific like writing agent's address or something more granular. It's going to stay defined as it is. Through the evolution, though, we have these minor releases that come out every 6 months. So in the second bullet down, we see we're looking at 2.10. What that minor release is telling me is that I have done changes to the standard, but I haven't changed the semantic of it, of the overall business message. For example, let's say that address doesn't initially support the ability to express a floor number. Well, we probably would want to add that. We realize that currently in version 2.8 of the standard, this is entirely hypothetical, 2.8 of the standard, we don't have floor number. Somebody needs to be able to use it. So they request to add floor number. We add it, and we add that to version 2.9. 2.9 is released, and address now has floor. I haven't changed the semantic meaning of address. I haven't changed the modeling of address. All of the information that you modeled in 2.8 is modeled exactly the same in 2.9. All that we've done in the release of 2.9 in this specific situation is added the additional ability to be able to express floor number. And that's where the minor release comes in. We do have occasionally technical releases. What a technical release is a situation where the standard, let's say, continue on with our address semantic, and somebody asked it to be floor number, that was the tag they used, and Let's just assume that the maintenance request asked for the floor number to be an integer, or a number, an actual number. And somehow that slipped through our vetting process. It gets approved and it gets put implemented into the standard, and there's floor number now defined as a number. Well, even though it made it through a 30 or 60 day release candidate, maybe 2 weeks after the standard out, somebody's trying to implement it and they say, you know what, floor numbers aren't always numeric. My floor number is floor 3A, or so it might be L, LL, M, etc. So in that situation, we realized, you know what, that's right. There was an error, or maybe they requested it to be a string and it somehow got implemented as a number. We probably need to do a technical release. In that situation, we will do a technical release. It will still be version 2.10, but we'll increment the last sets of numbers from 00 to 01 to let you know that there's a new technical release of the standard. In the eyes of the standard, in the eyes of Accord, in that situation, once we release 2.10.01, 2.10.00 goes away. And that kind of makes sense because we only do a technical release in situations where we realize that there's an error. Something needs to be fixed. So whatever got fixed in 2.10.01 needs to replace what was there before. And since what was there before wasn't usable, at least in its current in that standard, it doesn't make sense to try to keep both standards around. That doesn't mean somebody won't be transacting business and identify their message as 2.10.00. What it means is the assumption is if they were using a 2.10.00, they would only be using those portions that were also in 2.10.01. They couldn't have been using that broken section, for example. Finally, we have a release candidate, which I talked about before. We get a maintenance request approved. The maintenance request goes into a release candidate, sometimes referred to as a draft. That release candidate then needs to have its own version number so that we know that it can exist. Sometimes a release candidate will go through multiple revisions itself. We've had as many as three, but I think we've had as many as more in days gone by, but certainly in the last couple of years we've never had more than three. And we're down to usually there's only going to be one release candidate. That last release candidate ends in .90. Therein lies a little bit of confusion. The numbers are incrementally in line. 2.10 comes before 2.11. 2.10.01 comes before 2.10.02 or before 2.11. But what about 2.10.9? There's a potential confusion. 2.10.9 is a version that appears after 2.10 and before 2.11. But what it is really is it's the first release candidate for version 2.11. So don't be confused there in thinking that 2.10.9 is a replacement for 2.10. And quite frankly, it should never be implemented except perhaps in pilot. Although I've seen it, trading partners should not be transacting business on one of those release candidates, not in production, because as long as we're in that .90, .91, .92, as long as we're in that release candidate phase, it's considered in pilot, and essentially all bets are off. We can say we spelt a tag name wrong, we need to correct it, and we'll do that essentially as long as it was new to that release without regard to compatibility or concern that we're hurting members because they shouldn't have been transacting business on that release anyway. This concludes part three of our training session on the life and annuity standard, where today we talked about the defining the standard itself, what a release involves, and the standards process. Standards process. Standards process. Standards process.